This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Officials are now in the process of deciding the best way to facilitate construction of a new bypass on Highway 70 in Lenoir County with the least amount of impact to a historical Civil War battleground site. Lenoir County Commissioner J. Mac Daughtry is also chairman of the Lenoir County Transportation Committee. He says the highway project is intended to make travel to the coast quicker and transport of goods across the state easier.
Kinston Highway 70 bypass is part of a series of bypasses, including Goldsboro, which will be finished July 2015, Havelock, which is within a year or so of getting started on construction, the Kinston bypass, and eventually a New Bern bypass.
Daughtry is also the vice chairman of the Highway 70 Corridor Commission, which monitors all projects along the highway from Raleigh to the coast. He's been working with the DOT to create a single bypass in Lenoir County that would start in LaGrange and will exit the east side of the county near Dover. According to the Department of Transportation, of the 17 routes that are proposed, five run through the site of the Battle of Wise Fork, fought in 1865. Several Union armies scattered across eastern North Carolina were combining forces with Major General William T. Sherman before meeting Confederate opposition in Kinston. Local historian Lonnie Blizzard sets the scene.
The Wise Fork battle, Sherman was marching across the South and coming into North Carolina. The Confederates were trying to rally their troops, I guess, and keep the ones from the eastern part of the state, the Wilmington, New Bern area, from getting inland to join forces with Sherman as he moved up towards the center part of the state, Raleigh, Goldsboro area.
The Wise Fork battle culminated in Kinston being captured by Union forces when Confederate General Braxton Bragg, facing three Union armies, retreated across the Neuse River. Nearly 26,000 troops were involved in the conflict, making it the second largest battle in North Carolina during the Civil War. Lonnie Blizzard is the president of the nonprofit organization Lenoir County Battlefield Commission, dedicated to preserving local historic sites and battlefields.
If they would pick the right route and not go through a battlefield, that'd be the best case scenario. But if they do go through where the battle, some portion of the battle took place, and it is a field that's lost its historical integrity, you know, I personally don't see a major problem with it.
If the Transportation Department decides to locate the bypass on the battlefield, Blizzard thinks they should provide funds to help restore another area on the site.
I can see it can be a positive. It's just a matter of using common sense and working with the DOT and the route that a road would take to have the least damage. If there's going to be any damage, mitigate for it.
With the possibility of proposed bypass routes potentially impacting the battlefield, Lenoir County Commissioner Daughtry says it's impossible to keep development from encroaching on the site because the area is so large. The battlefield is estimated to be 5 to 7 square miles.
You can't protect the whole battlefield, because if you did, we'd have a dilemma, because there already exists on that battlefield, because of the size and scope of the Wise Fork battlefield, you'd have to take up existing Highway 70 in Lenoir County on the south, and you'd have to take up existing Highway 258, because both of those already exist and run through the Wise Fork battlefield.
But not all the impacts of the bypass may be negative. Daughtry says if the DOT decides to build a bypass on the battlefield, it could bring greater visibility to the historical significance of the site.
You can always look at things from two standpoints. You can say, oh my gosh, it's coming through and we don't want it run through the battlefield. But you also can take a look and say, if the local preservation folks come in and sit down with us and say, hey, let's partner with DOT. If we're going to run it, if it's going to come through here, let's take advantage of this opportunity and let's advertise, let's put the signage up, make sure that when folks come through here, they understand where it is, the significance of it.
With the many different interests, including Department of Transportation, Lenoir County officials, and historical preservation, it takes time to work through the details of the project and reach a compromise. Currently, an environmental impact study is underway. The results are due in the next year. In 2015, DOT hopes to identify a preferred alternative and hold public meetings. Construction could start between the year 2017 and 2020. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the 11th Annual Chamber Music Festival in New Bern next week. PRE classical music host Finley Woolston spoke with festival organizer and Greenville native Jennifer Lucht about the event.
We do have three concerts happening next week as part of the Carolina Chamber Music Festival in September. Classical lunch on September 10th from 12 to 1 will be held at the Christ Church Ministry Center, and that's going to feature Madi Azakiwe playing viola, one of our popular returning artists, and also the Calyx Piano Trio. Thursday we have Dvorak After Work, which is always fun, a little music, and then a little fellowship wine and cheese reception to follow that. That's held at 6 o'clock at Coleman Hall at the North Carolina History Center Tryon Palace. And Saturday is Classics Old and New, which is sort of self-explanatory. We're going to be doing Stravinsky, which is sort of an old new composer, and also Amy Beth Kirsten, a North Carolina premiere of a work that was written for the Calyx Piano Trio called Kiss to the Earth, and it's got some really interesting sonorities in it. I think that'll be interesting to share with everybody there.
Jen, what are the goals of the festival this year?
Well, one thing that we're doing with the festival in terms of our overall programming is looking to the past, but also looking towards the future and considering what's modern and showing older pieces and newer pieces side by side. And this Beethoven in particular, you know, we think Beethoven, a classical composer, you know, these masterworks, but this was, you know, he was such a tradition breaker. But this particular trio, I think, breaks tradition with some longer lines, and he's really starting to fragment his gestures and use motifs. And so it's one that I find very challenging as a performer to kind of think through, and it does seem like a real departure for him as far as his chamber music repertoire goes.
Jen, anything else going on with the Chamber Music Festival that we need to know about?
Well, let's see. I'd like to mention two things. One is that there's an instrumental combination that is infrequently heard that we're featuring in two concerts, and that is for one piano with two players, so piano four hands,
oh, yeah,
if you will. And both Melvin Chen and Nina Ferrigno, and Nina is part of the Calyx Piano Trio, and Melvin, of course, a wonderful and versatile musician who is a pianist, first and foremost, but also an amazing violinist. They'll be playing four-hand works by Dvorak and Schubert, and maybe I mentioned that's Thursday and Saturday. You'll be able to hear music for piano four hands, but
wow,
it is a seldom-heard combination, and we're really happy to be able to feature that. The last thing I would definitely like to mention is that this is the 100th anniversary of the Rite of Spring, and we, the Calyx Piano Trio, is fortunate enough to have a work composed for us by Amy Beth Kirsten. This is the Kiss to the Earth that I mentioned earlier that is based on the Rite of Spring, nods back to Stravinsky, and uses some of his compositional mannerisms and techniques. We're excited to be presenting this trio. It's getting its North Carolina premiere.
All right, so if folks want to attend, and I know they will, how do they go about getting tickets?
They can be obtained in person at the Craven Arts Council at their temporary location, which is at 308 George Street, across from the Tryon Palace. And you can call them directly at 252-638-2577, and they can provide more information.
Great. Jen, as always, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Finley. Nice to speak with you.
If you'd like more information on the 2013 Carolina Chamber Music Festival, visit publicradioeast.org and click on the little button that says Events.
The new CD from Carborough duo Mandolin Orange is entitled Other Side of Jordan. This title hints at the spiritual tone heard in the music, part inspired by circumstance, part inspired by the style of music the duo performs. George Olson has more.
For Andrew Marlin, the genesis of Mandolin Orange's third CD, This Side of Jordan, evolved from a near tragic incident in his own life back in 2011 that occurred around the release of the duo's second CD.
What happened? I was down on this dam, which is right down the road from where we live, you know, just hanging out. It's in a river, popular swimming spot, but it's a little early in the morning, and I just got a little too close, and I fell over the dam, and luckily I just broke my pelvis, but it was kind of an eye-opening experience, you know what I mean? It could have gone so many ways, and I think it definitely had a huge impact on this record, just kind of opening up my eyes to, like, our mortality and how crazy just little instances like that can go, you know? It could go one way or the other so fast.
But while Andrew says that accident definitely affected the production of This Side of Jordan, the spiritual aspect that runs throughout the disc may have come out anyway, given the style of music that he and partner Emily France partake in.
I grew up in the church. My mom, you know, she always played for the church when I was growing up. And so I think that those themes and a lot of the terminology that you would hear in those old tunes, you know, were always present. But, you know, also, I mean, all those same things also run through, like, old-time music and traditional songs, which is what, you know, we listen to a lot and sometimes try to emulate in our writing.
There's no time this side of Jordan. There's no light that I figured I'd just have a peek.
And the writing appears to be the thing with Mandolin Orange. While both are good instrumentalists, there's nothing of the hot-picking nature that you might find in acoustic music, more so in bluegrass, less so in old time. Their instrumental style tends to draw attention not so much to musical prowess as it does to lyrical content.
They're pretty low-key tunes, you know, with pretty melody, so we try and kind of stick to that, you know, stick to the same aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way we approach the songs when we're arranging them is just trying to make them try and complement the song itself, the melody and the lyrics as much as possible. And you know, we love to jam and play bluegrass and old time and sort of go for it a little more on our instruments, but it doesn't feel like that's what needs to happen on these songs. So we kind of hold back a little more.
But now some amazing sounds of hallelujah, dream about a mansion of gold. But to each be true and to each be known. My dreams all are resting on a house of stone. A house of stone.
Andrew accessed the duo's chief songwriter with Emily heavily involved in arrangements and sometimes just as a sounding board. She says her opinion isn't a be-all and end-all in Andrew's process, but at the same time,
I usually try and softly put my opinion out there and then let him draw his own and hope that it is the same as mine.
Still, the songs are mostly Andrew and more often drawing from his own experience. The somber tone of the disc might draw from his sense of mortality that arose from his 2011 accident. That in turn prompted some highly personal songs, the most personal perhaps being Turtle Dove and the Crow.
Turtle Dove and the Crow is a song where I'm just talking about my dad and him going to go see my mom on the other side of Jordan. You know, my mom died when I was 18, and so it's, you know, dealing with that hardship alongside of my dad and watching his progression as he kind of went down, and now he's coming out on the other side of it.
We shared a line that's in stone between two years. Pack my grave someday and go see her. Gonna climb that ladder, Jacob, won't you hold on? Just gotta drop me a line this side of Jordan. But
all the songs aren't first-person narratives. Andrew tried something on This Side of Jordan he never experimented with before, a song not of his own experience or purely from imagination, but drawn from the experience of others and trying to make it his own.
And when I wrote that song, there was a time about, kind of drew from my friend's experience with his divorce, and so obviously a lot of that's going to be left up to the imagination, you know, because I mean, I can only imagine a lot of the things he's going through, but I can only go on what he's telling me, and definitely inspired me to write that tune, but I think most of that is just kind of drawn from, you know, how would I feel during that, and, you know, what would be some of the things that might run through my mind.
If I showed up to your wedding wearing black and blue and red, wouldn't it seem fair?
But while the bulk of This Side of Jordan is highly personal songs that seem to preclude anyone else giving proper voice to them, Andrew did co-write one song which absolutely begs for other singers to take it up.
That was one that I wrote with a friend of mine, Dave Hutchison. We were driving back from Asheville and decided just to try and stay awake, we were going to start writing a tune. He's a really great songwriter. And so we put our heads together to just write, you know, a standard old country waltz. And that's what that one came out to be. Went into it with the intention we wanted to write a song about whiskey, and we wanted to write a waltz. And so Waltz About Whiskey was born.
So won't someone dance with me to a waltz about whiskey and turn sad songs to lullabies? Well, I don't need much or nothing except for all your loving and a waltz about whiskey on ice.
To my own ear, it's a song tailor-made for Merle Haggard. But while standing out among the highly personal songs that make up This Side of Jordan, its writing did include one bow toward that sense of mortality that influences the disc.
Well, we weren't drinking whiskey, so, you know, that was one thing helping us stay awake.
One quarter should do. Number 832. A little truth from the jukebox should make it all right. And as the booze sets in, I'm getting high again to a waltz about whiskey on ice.
Andrew Marlin and Emily France make up the duo Mandolin Orange, based out of Carrboro. Their new CD, This Side of Jordan, is available on Yep Rock Records. I'm George Olson.
Sad songs to lullaby.
This week, fishermen and divers in the Carolinas are learning about the invasion of lionfish and how to deal with them. The environmental nonprofit Reef is holding free classes to teach people about lionfish collecting and handling, lionfish biology, and ecological impacts. I spoke with communications and affiliate program manager Carrie Canning about the workshop and how lionfish came to be a problem for North Carolina's native fish populations.
Scientists have generally agreed now that they first made it into the Atlantic through aquarium releases. Some folks didn't want the lionfish they had in their aquariums, and they released them into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, we saw the first lionfish off Dania Beach in South Florida in 1985, and the first lionfish was found off North Carolina in 2000.
So the lionfish has been off the North Carolina coast for over a decade now. What has caused their populations to explode?
Well, for one thing, it's just been time. As you have more adults in the population, more reproduction is going on, and the population just increases and increases. Here in the Atlantic, there are really no checks on the lionfish population. They don't have predators because they're defended by 18 venomous spines. And they're quite adept at reproducing, and reproducing in huge numbers very often. So really, as long as food and shelter are available in the Atlantic ecosystem, we expect lionfish to keep increasing.
One of the more interesting things that I learned about lionfish is they don't necessarily go after a hook and line like most fish do. So that, of course, makes them harder to catch. What are some of the techniques used to gather lionfish and to control their population?
Sure. So actually, one of the biggest ways that lionfish are removed from the ocean is through the trapping industry. So whether that's fish traps or lobster traps, fishermen will deploy these traps and lionfish enter them because they really like the structure of the trap. So when the fisherman goes to pull the pot, if there's any lionfish inside, those come up as accidental bycatch. So whereas fishermen are not targeting lionfish, I know in the Florida Keys, lionfish are one of the top species of bycatch found in the traps, and they are brought up in great numbers. Last season, one of the lobster fishermen in the Florida Keys brought in about 6,000 pounds, or about 18,000 lionfish in a single season. So that's one method. But as you mentioned, for divers and snorkelers, both netting and spearing are other methods that lionfish are brought in. And during the invasive lionfish collecting and handling workshops, I'll be teaching people how to get in the water and how to use these nets and spears to effectively catch lionfish while keeping themselves safe.
About the workshops you've been holding this week, there was one in Wilmington on Wednesday and another in South Carolina on Thursday night. How's the response been so far?
We had a variety of people in attendance, ranging from recreational divers to dive masters to aquarium volunteers to middle school educators. It was great. The people asked a lot of questions, and we had a smaller group, so we were able to do a lot of hands-on demonstrations, and people could get their hands on the spears and the nets and get a good look at how they work.
So at these workshops, you're providing information about the lionfish and how humans can actually go about hunting them and catching them.
Yeah, so during the workshop, I actually teach through a few different methods. We start off by looking at videos of netting and spearing techniques so people can get an idea of what the whole process looks like from start to finish. And then I'll actually show them different kinds of nets and different kinds of spears. I'll go over the advantages and disadvantages of all the different kinds of gear, and I'll go over what different scenarios they would want to use those different tools and techniques for. And then I'll pull a volunteer out of the crowd and get them to come up, and I've got a little stuffed lionfish, like a little beanie baby, if you will, and we'll go ahead and put on the gloves and get out the nets, get out the spears, and run through a scenario of how they would catch that lionfish using either nets or spears.
And it's really a good thing to know how to handle these lionfish because they have these venomous spines on them that if you get stung, it hurts.
The venom that causes stings is actually a protein-based neurotoxin. It affects people differently. So for one person, it might feel like a bee sting. For another person, it might feel like they got their hand slammed in a car door and then lit on fire for a few hours. It can be pretty intense.
I understand there's going to be one more opportunity to attend the workshop next week. It's going to be in Moorhead City.
Yes, that one is on Monday at the North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores. It's from 6 to 8 p.m.
And if you want more information on the Lionfish Workshop, you can find it at our website, publicradioeast.org. Carrie Canning is the Communication and Affiliate Program Manager for REEF. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Okay, thanks, Jared. Have a good one.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. We have a wonderful native fruit ripening right now all around eastern North Carolina. It comes in different colors, bronze, red, black. All are delicious with a very intense fruity taste. They make great jellies and jams. Some people even use them to make wine. You know what I'm talking about. It's muscadine grape time. There are small wild muscadines growing everywhere around my house and the island where I live, and maybe around your house too. And they can be quite tasty, but the yield of delicious pulp compared to bitter seeds is pretty small. So if you want muscadine grapes, you probably should look into growing some of the cultivated varieties. They have all that wonderful flavor, but you get a lot more pulp and juice and fewer smaller seeds. People have been cultivating muscadine grapes in eastern North Carolina for a long time. There's a vine in Manteo, North Carolina that is estimated to be 400 years old. Muscadine vines get large and heavy, so if you're going to grow them, you need a really sturdy trellis. You want to space your vines about 10 feet apart. And recognize that it will take 3, maybe 4 years before they're yielding grapes. And the grapes, well, they're not going to grow in bunches like the white and red grapes you buy in the grocery store. They actually grow seemingly individually, but it's often actually large, loose clusters. When they're ripe, the muscadines have a wonderful fragrance, and they will lift easily from the stem. If you have to pull them hard, well, they're not ripe. And even ripe muscadine grapes have a thick skin, not like you're used to in bunch grapes. The skin has a little bit of a bitter flavor, but I personally like it. A lot of people don't. The way to eat a muscadine to avoid the skin is to simply squeeze the ripe grape directly into your mouth. But your work isn't done as you taste that wonderful juice. You're going to have to use your tongue and your teeth to sort the seeds from the pulp. It's not that difficult. It's really worth the effort to eat wonderful muscadines in eastern North Carolina this time of year. And if you want to grow grapes, well, it's the only kind that's really going to do well for you. You might get your grapevines to grow beautifully and yield bunch grapes for a little while, but it's usually short-lived. Go out and find some muscadines, whether in the wild, maybe even in a farmer's market. And once you find one that you really enjoy, plant a vine yourself, and you'll be enjoying it, well, for years to come. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.